Good evening. Welcome to today's talk. We'll begin with some meditation as usual. And then we'll proceed. May we have some music, Azam? Sensations of the body to settle down. Allowing all thoughts in the mind to settle down. And I bring my mind to focus on the present moment. On the here and now, sitting here in this room, on this chair. I turn my attention away from the world outside to the world within. I withdraw my attention to the world within, going deep within myself, to the center of my being, to the center of the brain, where I see my entire existence concentrated. Concentrated into a point. The spark of consciousness. Energy concentrated to infinity. Indivisible, indestructible. My original and eternal identity. The existence of the soul, the spirit. That which was before this body was, that which will be. After this body is no more. I experience my entire existence concentrated. Into the form of a spirit. Just a speck of consciousness. I experience this physical world and this physical body disappear from my awareness. All that remains is light. I, the soul. I, the eternal spirit. The sparkling star. I see myself in a dimension of light, beyond space, beyond time, and I see myself in the presence of God, the light of all lights, shining down upon me. And I am bathing in this light of peace. In this eternal fountainhead of purity. Concentrated on this union, this communion between the soul and the supreme, two beings of light. Two sparkling stars of conscient living energy. Absolute stillness. I feel the power of silence. A silence that is full. I, the eternal spirit, bathing in the light of God, the ocean. Swimming in the waves of silence. And holding on to this light and the silence. And this healing companionship of the Supreme, I allow my awareness to return back to this world of matter, this field of action, back to this body, this costume of mine. Once again, I take my place in the center of the brain, looking out, through the windows of these eyes, listening through these ears. I, the eternal spirit within, a being of light, a being of peace. Peace, my original nature. Peace, my only religion. Om Shanti.
Today we will speak about resilience. So for the past, I think, a couple of decades at least, if not a little more than that, there has been a lot of talk on resilience in the world, right? Things have been becoming tougher. Situations have been becoming tougher for people. Stress has been increasing a lot in the world. Anxiety, they say the 21st century is a century of stress and anxiety. A lot of stress, a lot of anxiety, a lot of difficulties in the world. Natural calamities have also been increasing. Situation at the job place is not as secure as it used to be. So now more than ever, we need this power to deal with these difficult challenges we face. And so, to address these challenges, people have spoken about this concept of resilience. So what is resilience? Very often when they speak about a material, the resilience of a material or the resilience of a metal, they say the extent to which the amount of energy any material can take before deforming permanently. So any substance, how much can it take before deforming permanently? It can deform temporarily. There is some elasticity, right? In deforming, it sort of comes back. But the extent to which it can take this energy without becoming deformed completely. People speak about material, metals like that. We are, of course, here speaking about the mind, about the self. To what extent can we absorb this pressure coming from the world without deforming completely? Without breaking, that's resilience. The ability to resist the pressures being put upon us in various forms. So when we speak about resilience, we can speak about many things. We will speak of three experiences where we need this experience of resilience, or three sources of challenges that we face in our lives where we need this experience of resilience. We will speak of these three things today. One is this experience of loss or bereavement, when we lose something very, very precious to us. It could be a relationship, for example, because of death, for example, or separation. There is a loss. It could be in terms of something we value, for example, if there is a natural calamity, people lose their house, for example. More than a house, it's their home. The memories are associated with that. They lose that. It could be the loss of a job. A loss of something that is of great value to people. And as the world becomes more and more uncertain, losses are very often unpredictable. They just happen. How do individuals respond to losses? How do they deal with these losses? That becomes a big issue. The other thing that we will speak about is the experience of trauma, another source of great challenge in the world. Trauma, of course, the loss can also lead to trauma. But trauma is the experience of some injury. There is an injury I experience, either a physical injury, but more typically we are speaking of these deep inner psychological injuries people carry with them. And this is the experience of trauma. And then, of course, a much more common experience is the experience of stress. when we feel that the demands being placed upon me exceed the resources available. These could be physical resources, but they could also be social, psychological resources. The demands being placed upon me exceed the resources I have, physical, psychological, social resources I have. And so I feel this inability of meeting these demands being placed upon me, resulting in the experience of stress. And we know the various consequences of stress, physical, psychological, behavioral, various consequences. There have been some calculations being made by the International Labour Organization, many other countries. They try to calculate the cost of stress, the actual cost in terms of money. Because when we get stressed, our productivity goes down, people are absent from jobs. There are lots of implications to stress, right? They go on medical leave, for example. So in terms of numbers, right, in places like Denmark and Sweden, it's something like between 11, 17 million euros. But in countries like the US, there are some estimates that project the cost of stress to be between $200 and $300 billion. That's more than the net profit of all the Fortune 500 companies put together. That's the cost in terms of numbers. So even in terms of economy, we know. But of course, we look more at the inner havoc the experience of stress creates. So we have these experiences, loss, trauma, and stress, right? And many times we have difficulty dealing with these issues. But how do human beings respond to these experiences? Let's take up first the experience of loss. We lose something that is very precious to us, right? The response to loss, we can imagine, would be quite negative, right? Yes. But you know something? We have some very interesting research coming up that shows that most people are actually okay. They don't respond to loss in such a negative way that it affects their life and their work and their career. They don't. Research shows that losing a relationship, losing a loved one, for example, because of death, disease, some chronic illness, research shows that between 10 to 15% of people who undergo loss bereavement, only 10 to 15% show signs of chronic depression or distress. That is 80, 85 to 90% of people, they experience a little bit, but they get over it. It doesn't really affect their life. It doesn't. More than 50% of people show either no symptoms or very minor symptoms of depression and distress following the experience of loss and bereavement. So people say, what does it mean? Are people cold? They don't feel anything. They lose someone they love. They don't feel. It's not that they don't feel. But it does not become debilitating. They do feel those pangs. It does not become debilitating. So one study was conducted on couples. So you say, how do you know what the relationship of these two people were once one of them has passed away, right? There's no way of knowing. But there was a very interesting study done where they actually could do a study 3 years before they lost the partner. And they did a lot of interviews from both the partners, but also from family members and friends about their relationship. And most of these people had very close, intimate, loving relationships. It's not that they were cold or they were waiting for the other to kick the bucket so they find some sense of relief, right? Not at all. They actually had very close, loving relationships. There seems to be, what it tells us, there seems to be a human capacity that we may not always tap into. And research also shows, the human mind tends to focus on negative experiences 5 times more than positive experiences. So we look at some experiences of loss and trauma which have affected us very deeply. We forget many other experiences which we would have coped with actually quite well. And the implications is, if we can remember that we can actually cope with these things and we have coped with them before, we'll be able to cope with them again. We tend to forget that. A lot of research comes up, even trauma. Let's look at trauma. Post-traumatic stress disorder. There is so much of talk on that in the world. Of course, there are so many wars being fought in the world. So much of conflict in the world. So we have higher incidence of post-traumatic stress disorder, right? There are studies also conducted on post-traumatic stress disorder. For example, in the US, there is some estimate 50 to 60% of the US population is exposed to through trauma and traumatic experiences. Only 5 to 10% develop PTSD. 50 to 60% are exposed to traumatic experiences. Only 5 to 10% actually develop PTSD. Most people are actually okay. They are able to deal with it themselves. Studies conducted on people returning from Afghanistan, all the countries that send the soldiers, they return from Afghanistan. Many of them have had difficulties. 62.5% of these soldiers returning show absolutely no signs of PTSD, not even minimal signs of PTSD, even a year after their return. The remainder show some signs, and it's only very few who actually have a full-blown episode of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. So we are beginning to understand that we speak about trauma and loss, and then we think about someone has lost someone, who they need help. And so there has been this myth in psychology practice that if someone has experienced trauma or traumatic, they need some debriefing, they need some counseling, they need some therapy. Yes, but very few actually need it. Not all need it. And that also shows the human capacity. There is an innate capacity where people can naturally deal with it. The question is, how do you tap into it? And so when we look at the experience of resilience, we see in the response to things like loss, stress and trauma, mainly loss and trauma, we see one experience of resilience is actually people remain unaffected. This is also an experience that we actually see. People remain unaffected. They experience the trauma, they remain unaffected. I'm sure you can identify some experiences in your life. I'll share with you my own experience. Once I remember, it was a very painful experience, but it lasted for, I think, maybe one evening. That's it. In school, I remember when I was very young, in school, I was accused of something very serious, which I hadn't done. I was accused of stealing something. I was very young. I was between 5 and 6. So a lot of this circumstantial evidence was against me, right? And two of my friends, who actually were not my friends, decided to take that as an opportunity to, you know, grind their axe against me because I had a fight with them a few days ago. So they even gave witness that, yeah, this guy. Yeah, because then, you know, they wanted to have it. They wanted to take revenge. And three, four teachers all around me accusing me that, admit, you have to admit, then, you know, it's okay. It's okay if you did it, just admit it. Very nice teachers. They're actually very nice people, I'm still in touch with them. And just admit and it's okay, it'll be all right. I didn't want to admit because I hadn't done it, right? And it went on and on and on, and I was crying and I was feeling a lot of, you know, I said, why this is so unfair and everything. But I wanted people to stop. I admitted to doing something I hadn't done because I just wanted people to stop accusing me, and I wanted to have some experience of love, you know. And the moment I admitted, the teachers were very happy with me. Finally, he has admitted, right? It was a very painful experience, a traumatic experience. You have been accused of something that you haven't done, and you're made to admit a crime that you haven't performed. And this other girl who actually stole that stuff, she came and she admitted to me later on. The very next day she comes and she tells me, and she was there that day, but you know, obviously she was scared. She was a young child like I was, right? Very, very scared. The next day she comes and tells me that I had done it. And then of course I had the choice of going and telling my teacher. And she said, if you want, you can tell everybody that I did it. I said, no, I won't do it. And actually, when I look back on that experience, I have my relationship with these teachers, those same people, those three teachers I remember. I still have a relationship with them, a very nice relationship. They have done many nice things for me afterwards. I have done many nice things for them later. I don't hold the grudge at all because I know it was a misunderstanding. It was a simple misunderstanding. I didn't need any post-traumatic stress debriefing for that. No, I didn't. This girl was my friend. She's still in touch with me. She lives in the U.S. now. She studied there, and she's sort of married and has children, and all that. We still speak at least 2 or 3 times a year. We speak on phone. We are very good friends. And it's nothing great. It's nothing great. All of us, I'm sure, have had such experiences. We may have forgotten them. It's not always that we need this help and support. Yeah, it's good. We should have it if we need it. But it's not always required. The human soul has the capacity to overcome these experiences quite naturally. One is the experience when we remain unaffected.
The other is the experience of resilience where people actually bounce back. So they may have an effect. They experience an effect, but then they quickly bounce back. Another experience that research is actually telling us about these days is there are some people who actually grow. They reach higher levels of performance, higher levels of adjustment after the experience of trauma and loss. People speak of post-traumatic growth. That's a concept, and a lot of research is being done in that these days. There is post-traumatic stress disorder. There is also post-traumatic growth, because there are some people who are able to use their experience of trauma to feed their growth, and they actually reach higher levels of performance, adjustment, and competence after the experience of trauma. There are quite a few celebrities who become celebrities because they use the experience of trauma that they had to fuel their growth. One example is the American television hostess Oprah Winfrey. Traumatic experience of childhood where she was sexually abused. She used that to fuel a sense of purpose in life. So there are also just such experiences. So now when we look at trauma and loss and stress, it need not be all bad. The question is, how do we use this? How do we use this innate capacity that seems to be there in the human soul to deal with the experiences of stress, trauma, and loss? How do we use this innate capacity? And that is what we will try and look at today. Yes? So I will ask you a question for your reflection. And the question is this. Think of a time in your life when you had some experience of stress or trauma or loss. Typically you could look at some experience of loss or trauma which you dealt with effectively. You may have got affected, but you dealt with it effectively. You dealt with it effectively and you could manage, you could deal with it. What was it that you were doing at that time? Spend a minute or two on this. A time in your life when you dealt effectively with an experience of loss or trauma or stress. What helped you in dealing with the situation? What helped you in dealing with that loss, trauma, or stress? How did you deal with it? What helped you in holding your ground and moving on? So, 2 minutes. Yes, thoughts? So, what helped you in dealing with such situations? Yes?
Total detachment.
Total detachment. How did you achieve that detachment?
I don't know. I actually have no clue. Mm. You stand in front of a situation, you just know you have to act, something has to be done. You don't even go into emotions at all.
No. So you're actually facing the situation.
Totally.
You're facing it?
Yeah.
And maybe that facing is it, but you're not affected by it, is what you're saying.
I don't go there.
No.
I could I could go into...
You could go that, into that inner experience.
Terror, but because it's so serious, I know don't go there.
No.
You know, just act.
Yeah.
What has to be done now?
Mm. And you're acting at the same time.
Yeah.
You're not avoiding the situation.
No.
You're avoiding that effect of the situation, but you're not avoiding the situation. No. You're actually confronting the situation.
Yes.
Okay. Interesting. So we will speak about this. So one is, of course, this whole thing of, let's say, confronting. Confronting reality, facing reality, dealing with reality, at the same time moving away from the inner experience, not letting yourself go there. Yes. Yes?
Acceptance
of the situation. Acceptance of the situation. So we're looking at confronting reality, we are looking at acceptance of the situation, which also, of course, means acceptance of the reality. That is how it is. Acceptance of the reality. You also spoke about the experience of detachment. Now, what else? Yes? Sorry?
Followed by determination.
Followed by determination. Transforming it into something positive.
Yeah.
That is, you're extracting meaning from it.
Yeah.
You're extracting meaning. So transforming that into something positive, you are seeing or constructing some meaning in the whole experience, in the situation. Yes?
Changing from feeling a victim to taking responsibility.
Okay. Regaining your sense of control over the situation. Yes? So regaining control, and you said something about taking responsibility.
Instead of feeling like a victim.
Yeah, taking responsibility rather than feeling like a victim. Yes?
Consulting,
like drawing on support.
Yeah.
Drawing on support, so we could say social support, this also helps us. But you take the initiative, right? That's what you're saying. Drawing on support from someone. Yeah. What else? Yes? Trying, again, meaning, sense of meaning. But meaning can come in various ways. So, for example, learning. Using that situation as something that I can sort of learn from. Learning, that gives us a sense of meaning. What else? Yeah.
Sense of duty towards myself, obligation towards life.
Mm. Sense of duty. What do you mean by that?
I mean that you can't just give up. You need to...
But once again, taking it in your hands, taking it back, regaining your sense of control through that sense of duty is what you, this is my love, I can't allow it to just get, regaining that sense of control. Yes, yes, Bo?
I found it valuable to realize that the situation is not very serious, but I am. The real value for me is myself.
Yeah, okay. So,
that's the fuel to go on.
You are re-evaluating the situation. Similar, I think, perhaps to what Leila said, that it is, I am too precious to be affected by this.
Yeah,
something like that?
Yeah, but it's not a mind process, it's a feeling.
Yeah, but what is that feeling that you're speaking about?
Love, basically.
Love for the self.
Yeah.
Generating that respect and love for the self. Yes, anything else that you are speaking about? Or value for the self, perhaps you would like to put it that way.
In a situation I experienced, I started to set the other person free who had done the action towards me. To say, I set you free, you can be and see and do what you want, and I take my response accordingly. And that took out the excess of energy within me so that I could look at more objective.
So, are you saying that instead of, very often we blame the other for our situation, instead of that,
yes,
you take the responsibility back into your hands and you set the other free? Yeah? So once again, I regain my sense of control. My sense of control over my own inner emotions, actually. Others are not controlling my emotions. I set them free. Very interesting. Again, the sense of control, we have that. Yes? Anything else? Yeah?
Well, immediate laughter sometimes is sort of a distraction.
Sorry?
I want to avoid it. Do something completely different.
Okay. Move, sort of distract yourself from that situation.
Yeah.
Focus on something else.
Yeah. Come back to it when I'm more
And then with time, what happens? Does it work in the long term in that way?
Well, I think so, because maybe the thing I do is something I do have control over. So maybe it's...
Okay, so once again, the distraction is giving me back my sense of control.
Yeah.
And then perhaps I can address the situation again later.
Yeah.
So we're again looking at a process of obtaining some control. So you could say, again, it's a way of detaching from the situation, perhaps. Moving away from the situation. Anything else that you can think of? Yes?
Love me.
Yeah, so.
Love me and talk about this.
Mm.
When I talk about this, I can see the things in different aspects.
Yeah, social support again. In some way, I'm drawing on social support, yes?
Sometimes I notice that it helps that when you experience something very intensely negative, at least within yourself, and going deeper within that feeling actually helps to release it.
Going deeper within that feeling, what do you mean? Because some people would say, well, if you're going deeper into that feeling, you're beginning a negative spiral.
No, it's not so much about a negative spiral as it is, let's say, I feel really hurt. So I sit with that hurt.
So
I understand where that hurt comes from. Once I get it, I let it go.
So once again, we are looking at actually confronting reality, facing reality, holding that reality, not denying it, not suppressing it, actually holding that reality in our consciousness. Yes? Withdraw, detachment, withdraw in various ways that we work with. The challenge here, of course, is when we speak of processes of detachment, withdrawal. There is a point of view that says that that's like repressing, right? You repress. And then after some time, what you have pushed away comes out very strongly. Repressed feelings emerge strongly. Interestingly, when we look at research on the matter, we have some very interesting and contradictory findings. Some researchers say that when you look at grief, many people say when someone has passed away, someone close to you, it's good to get it out, cry, express it, and if someone is not doing it, you're sort of pushing it inside and it has to be released. Actually, there is almost no support for that. At least that aspect of a grief which is supposed to be absent for some time and then it will come out someday at some point in time. There is not much support for that. There could be anecdotal evidences, but there is not a lot of support for that. At the same time, we also know, when we look at mental illnesses, we also know a long history, many, many years of repressing certain feelings and experiences can result in some problems, psychological problems. So you have interesting contradictory findings on that. I think the jury is still out on that issue. But there is clear evidence to show that repressive coping, which basically we will say you move away from their reality for some time, some people will say that's repression, but it actually tends to work. And when it works, it doesn't mean that after some time, after some months and years, that problem will actually come out. No. Actually, creating that space seems to be giving people the strength to actually deal with that issue later. It gives them that distance that so that they can deal with that issue later. So in that way, it can actually work in some situations. As long as we are aware of what we are doing. The problems probably come when we do this without being aware of the pain. I'm aware of the pain and I recognize, like you said, I don't want to indulge in that pain. I know the pain is there. But once I go there, I'm going to go deeper and deeper into that. So I know that and I distance myself from that. That's one experience. The other experience is denying the existence of the pain, and that probably leads to issues. So there is a lot of work going on this, and what you have said, we put it all together. This is actually a very nice illustration of the various things that we do to deal with these issues. We will try and organize it today. We will organize it conceptually so that we can look at, if tomorrow I have this experience, what do I do? What do I actually do to deal with this experience? Drawing on my own inner resources, what do I do to deal with this experience? But anything else you would like to add here? Apart from what you have said, anything else you would like to add?
Maybe with the, just thinking about realizing how lost I was.
Realizing what?
How lost I was. So that in the confronting that reality.
Okay. Confronting that reality. Confronting the reality is what you're saying?
Yeah, but gaining some kind of giving another azimuth towards
giving another
azimuth towards my perspective.
Giving another direction?
Another, yeah. How do you see things?
Okay. So are you speaking about the construction of meaning?
Like the example that when I have an accident, like a car accident, and then, you know, it was quite traumatic, and realizing what triggered. And in that sense, realizing, oh, I can't be on that. You know, you have to be concentrated. And when you're on the road, you can't have too many.
So using that experience as a learning situation is what you're saying.
Yeah.
I learn from that. I construct meaning from it.
And from that experience, grow.
Yeah. Okay. Right. So in construction meaning, in various ways we construct meaning. Now, I will speak about something that has been spoken about a lot when we look at processes of, say, managing or dealing with these various experiences, be they experiences of loss, of stress, or trauma. There has been some work done on a personality characteristic that is spoken of as, okay, I think I'm running out of space, so I'm going to... These are the various things we do to manage. But there is a personality characteristic that is very often spoken of as hardiness. And this is where we will go now. Hardiness is basically many of these things that we have spoken about. There are two researchers that have been doing a lot of work on it. And it's very, very interesting because their insights take us into actually a very spiritual area. And this is psychological work, right? But a very interesting area. One of them is a person called Maddy, M-A-D-D-I. I don't know how you pronounce it. Maddy, Nancy? Maddy? Maddy, okay. The other is Kobasa. And these two people have been doing a lot of work on this concept of hardiness, psychological hardiness. When we speak of hardiness, we also refer to plants. Plants that can grow in the absence of adequate conditions for growth are said to be hardy. In the absence of adequate conditions of growth, they're actually growing. So we say absence of adequate conditions, whatever we call them in our life, absence of adequate conditions for growth, people can still grow. And that is captured in this concept of hardiness, which is a personality, you could say, characteristic, personality style, a pattern of thinking, behaving, and feeling that is captured in this concept. And there are three components to that. One is, so we look at the components of hardiness. The first is looking at life and experiences as a challenge rather than the experience of threat. And there are very clear opposites that we look at here. For example, looking at life as a challenge versus looking at life as a threat. Looking at experiences as a challenge, looking at loss, trauma, and stress as a challenge versus looking at these experiences as a threat to various things. So this is the first characteristic. The second characteristic that people have been speaking about a lot is what is referred to as commitment versus the experience of avoidance. And commitment here means that I am fully engaged with my world in the experience of loss, trauma, or stress. I remain completely engaged with my world. I do not avoid the world. I do not avoid that situation. And I'll give you examples of that in terms of what it means functionally. And the third experience that people have been speaking about is the experience of control. And this is posited against the experience of, say, powerlessness on the one hand, but also the experience of rigidity. Rigidity is where you're trying to exercise too much control because you're afraid of losing control. Right? So, and that's suffocating. That's suffocating for individuals who are doing it. It's suffocating for other individuals who are in the surrounding. So typically when people feel insecure many times, they try to impose a lot more control so they can feel safe. So that's rigidity. Here when we speak about control, of course, we are speaking about this experience of inner control where I don't give up and I take the full responsibility, basically, for the experience. That's the meaning here. So I'll take a few examples here. So when we speak about challenge, basically, looking at life as a challenge, what does it mean? So research in this area tends to show people who survive experiences of loss, trauma mainly, and of course also stress, they have a natural trait or a tendency of searching for meaning in situations. And the belief is change is the norm. They work with the assumption change is the norm. Stability is not the norm of this world. Change is the norm. Since change is the norm, I expect change. And this change could be in my work, this change could be in relationships, this change could be in any dimension of my life, but change is the norm. Since they have this belief that change is the norm, they are prepared for change. When change does come, they are prepared for change. Then, of course, we will look at what is underlying these three processes of challenge, control, and commitment. We will do that later, but basically, that's the meaning. So when we look at challenge, we're looking at understanding that life changes, and I need to be ready for that change. And how do they deal with change? One of the characteristics of these people is they construct meaning, they see meaning. They actively engage in processes of deriving, deducing, squeezing out meaning from the most difficult circumstances. Constructing meaning. Many of you have already spoken about that, right? Learning, for example. What do I learn? That's one way of constructing meaning. Right? Many of you may know, we keep speaking of this many times, I think, this Austrian psychiatrist, Viktor Frankl. He was from a Jewish family, he was captured during the Second World War, he went to a concentration camp, and he was, I think he also spent time in Auschwitz, and he was one of those very few who survived the concentration camps. And later on, people, before telling you the story, how many of you don't know of this guy, Viktor Frankl? Please raise your hands. Okay, there are quite a few. Don't know, a little bit, okay. So, later on people asked, and he wrote, of course, a full book on this, Man's Search for Meaning, very interesting. And he said, what he observed was, some people would have very serious illnesses in the concentration camps, and yet they would survive, in spite of the very not optimum conditions for survival, not proper food, there was not enough warmth, no good hygiene. They would survive. And some people would have a simple illness, say a common cold. It would become worse. Eventually they would die. And he saw many such experiences where some people were able to deal with very great difficulties and some people, small things would affect them a lot and they would collapse. And he started speaking to these people about what was it, and he discovered those who could construct a meaning in their suffering were the ones who could actually harness enough power to even overcome serious physical problems and serious physical illnesses. Meaning in their suffering. For example, Hawaii, he gives an example of one of the people he was speaking to. And this person said to him, how do you deal with these situations? He said, if I die, then they win. I can't allow them to win. Then if they win, then evil wins. I can't allow that. I have to live. I have to live to show that you cannot destroy my life. You can take away my family, you can kill and remove all the things that are of value to me, but you cannot take away my life. He managed to construct his meaning in that way, and that helped him in surviving the strong sense of purpose. And from that, of course, Viktor Frankl developed his whole therapy. It's called logotherapy. And the whole therapy is focused on looking at meaning, constructing meaning in difficult, traumatic, painful situations. How do I learn? How do I transform that? Use that as sort of a fuel to actually... And Viktor Frankl actually became famous because of this system of therapy called logotherapy. So that's one example of post-traumatic growth. I go through a trauma, I use that experience to construct meaning, I create meaning for myself, but I also contribute to the world through those experiences. Construction of meaning, yes?
There are also some research showing that sense of trauma also works in consumption.
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
Lightness. The ability to look at things from a different perspective. which is also that, right? The ability to look at things from a different perspective. So now when I am in an experience like that, and some of us may be struggling with some experiences that we are unable to forget from our past life experiences in this, we could probably look at, okay, so what is the meaning? How do I construct meaning from this whole situation? Those who can actually survive. Then we go to the, so instead of looking at the experience as threat, I see meaning in that. Simple, constructive things. I lose my job. There is also research on this. The people who lose their jobs or are laid off, who are the people who are able to get back into the job market? There's also research on this. Who are those who are more likely? We know there is a lot of research that shows that the longer you remain out of the job market, the more difficult it is for you to get back into the job market, right? Because there are lots of other processes that are involved. It's not just your competence. It's how their experience of not having a job affects us psychologically, etc. People who are able to do that, again, they are able to use that as an opportunity to develop their skills, develop their competences. They confront that reality. They transform, they see meaning out of that. And they also do something else, and that is this other thing, commitment. Commitment means you face reality. You face reality by engaging with the reality. Don't move away from that reality. What does it mean? At a very basic level, say someone in a relationship has been nasty to you. Someone has been nasty. Someone has said something very hurtful to you. Right? What is your reaction? What is your response to that person? You're hurt. One response is people avoid meeting that person again. Right? Because of the fear. Meet the person again, I'll be hurt again. And we're not aware of the fear that is controlling us. We avoid. When we speak about commitment, what we mean is, if the person hurts me, I continue to engage with that person. I continue to engage with that person the way I engaged with that person before I was hurt. And the more I do it, the more I do it, I am actually regaining my sense of control, because then your behavior is not controlling me. I actually experimented with this once, I remember. Myself, I have experimented many times. And working with myself, you see, people have been nasty to you, people have been unfair to you, you actually engage with them. You help them in heal themselves. In healing themselves, because if they've been nasty to you, they're carrying guilt. They are carrying guilt. You continue to engage with them, you continue to give them love. You release them of their guilt. Not only do you release them of their guilt, they become great friends of yours. Because you have helped them in healing themselves. You've helped them in releasing them from guilt. It has major implications for that relationship. You've been a faithful friend for life. You benefit eventually. But you don't do it because of benefit. But, you know, the inner feeling. If I do it, then it's manipulation. Then eventually people find out and it doesn't work for me. But commitment here means continuing to engage with this world. Now, I'll give you another example from another area. Have you heard of this guy called Stockdale? Stockdale was an admiral during the American occupation of Vietnam. He was an admiral, a U.S. admiral. And he was captured by the Viet Cong. And I think he spent something like 8 years or something like that, tortured by the Viet Cong. And then afterwards, of course, he survived and he came out and people asked him, how did you... So who were the people who could not survive these years of torture? He said, oh, that's easy. These were the optimists. Optimism is good, right? You should be hopeful and optimistic of the future. He said, the ones who perished were the optimists. What does it mean? People asked him. He said, they're very optimistic. They felt by Christmas they would be out, then Christmas goes away. By Easter will be out, Easter goes away. By Thanksgiving will be out, Thanksgiving goes away. By Christmas will be out, Christmas goes away. Eventually they perish because they get disillusioned, disappointed. There is a lot of research showing that optimism has its own issues. Optimism, which is not, when it is not grounded in reality, it has serious issues. It gives short-term boosts, but in the long term, it doesn't have much utility. Commitment also means you face reality. And there's a lot of research on this. You face reality, meaning you look at the worst and you look at the best, and you hold both things simultaneously in your awareness, and you focus on what is possible. You ignore the negative situation. I'll give you another example from a company, Morgan Stanley. 1993, there was an attack on the World Trade Center. Before the 2001 attack, 1993, there was the first attack on the World Trade Center. Right? After that, the people, it was okay, it didn't create so much of a damage. Morgan Stanley realized that if you are working, you're having offices in a place with a symbol of power, such things can happen. From 93, they had a very clear discipline of training all the people. There were 2,700 people working in the World Trade Center, employed by Morgan and Stanley on 2001. Only 7 of them died. Why? And there's a reason behind that. So 1993, when the attack first happened at the World Trade Center, these people recognized that this can happen anytime. They thought it happened once, America, we are the greatest country in the world, we have great intelligence, it'll never happen again. Of course not, it can happen again. Many other companies forgot that. They said it can happen again. They had drills, they had training, few times in a year, they had mock exercises. So if there is an attack on the center again, what do we do? They had a clear orchestrated drill. And they practiced it every year, many times a year, from 93 to 2001. 8-9 years, right? And so when the plane hit the first tower, they knew what to do. It was automatic. The person in charge of the drill guided everybody. Everybody got out. Only 7 people who were left behind. And these were the people, most of them were the ones who were responsible for guiding everyone out. They eventually perished. Not just that. Morgan Stanley also had a backup operation place in a warehouse which they kept for all these years, even though they were not using it. So these 2,693 people that escaped, very next day they were moved to that location. Not the very next day, but very soon they were moved to that other location. The company continued its operations. See? Bouncing back from adversity. But this requires a lot of... So you say, one is facing reality, and when we look at control, how do we get control? One way of getting control is through disciplines, routines, procedures. Another company, UPS, also in America, 1992, there was Hurricane Andrew that hit Florida. UPS was the only, it delivered packages to people who were stranded in their cars during this time. They didn't stop operations. And then researchers studied their operations. What do these people do that is very, very different? UPS has a very boring regimen every day. You know, people have to put their keys at the same place. Very clear routines and procedures. But these routines and procedures help them because in times of stress, people fall back into their habitual routines and procedures. And when I have created clear disciplines and routines in my daily life, in times of stress, I fall back, but then they help me in actually dealing with the situation, and they help me overcome. Disciplines, procedures, they may be very boring. Like, for example, waking up every day in the morning at 4 o'clock and meditating. Sometimes it's problematic for me also. Oh my God, again, tomorrow. Come on, tomorrow I can sleep. Right? Why wake up? You do it, and you do it, and you do it, and you do it. Even if you don't like it, you do it. You begin to like it. And then after a few days, you don't like it anymore. You still do it. You begin to like it, then you don't like it, but you still do it. And in times of stress, in times of strain, this practice that has led to the accumulation of capacity helps you deal with that. Discipline, some discipline. So a lot of people use this in life saying, create some discipline that is consistent, constant, every day. You do that consistently. Over a long period of time, you accumulate strength. Because any discipline, what does it mean basically? Through the discipline, I'm experiencing control. Every time I engage in the discipline, I'm experiencing control. So every time I make myself wake up in the morning and sit down for meditation, I'm overcoming the other aspect of me that is pulling me, making me want to stay in bed under my duvet, you know, in the nice warmth. It's making me get out, and through that I am overcoming, I'm actually regaining control. I'm developing control. And over a period of time, that becomes a source of great, immense strength. There is also research that shows people who obtained high-class performance, chess, music, right? People who obtain high-class performance, who become very, very well-known in their fields, they are not typically those who have the highest level of talent. No. They are the ones who have had the highest level of discipline. Every day they've practiced, they've practiced, they've practiced. And that practice gives them that competence, that capability, that ability to actually have long-term sustainable success in whatever field they have chosen. So these are some things that we look at here, this challenge, commitment and control. How do we develop that rather than getting into this experience of powerlessness or avoiding situations and avoiding difficulties and giving into the experience of threat? And this is where we go into the understanding of identity. And this is, of course, very close to what we speak about spiritually. Maddie has spoken about very long, this was in 1960s, he started speaking about these things. And then, of course, a lot of research came into hardiness. Who are the people who are likely to be hardy? Who are the people who are likely to display challenge as against threat, commitment as against avoidance, control as against powerlessness and rigidity? Who are these people who are able to do that? So he categorizes two forms. He speaks about two forms of identity. One he speaks about as the, let's say, the pre-morbid identity. Where do I have run? I always run out of space. Okay, so I'll write it here. Pre-morbid. And the other is the ideal identity. What does it mean? The ideal identity is related to this experience of hardiness. The pre-morbid identity is related to the experience of threat, avoidance, powerlessness, and rigidity. The pre-morbid identity, according to him, is the one that defines itself. When I look at myself, who I am. This is the identity that defines itself in terms of two things mainly. One is the social roles I perform, and the other is the biological needs I have. Simple example. I have decided to wake up in the morning. That's my challenge, right? So wake up in the morning at 4 o'clock, and I haven't had enough sleep in the night. I've had, say, 4 hours of sleep. So 4 o'clock, the alarm rings. I get up. I put it off. How do I explain it to myself? I need to sleep, you know. I make myself wake up. And these are things that we sometimes don't pay a lot of attention to. Of course I need to sleep. But get up, do the stuff, and then maybe in the daytime you can. And there is a lot of strength in that. If we practice it, there is a lot of strength in that. We actually need lesser sleep than we think we do. That doesn't mean you stop sleeping, of course. We need to sleep. But you know what I mean. Oh, I need to eat this. Really? You need to eat? You need to have that much sugar and pastry and cake? I need to. Biological needs. I let myself be taken over by the biological so-called need. Sometimes I can work on controlling and regulating it. And social roles are the roles we say an employee in an organization, a psychologist, a manager, the roles that we play, mother, father, son, daughter, the various roles that we play, social roles. We identify ourselves according to those roles means, of course, our sense of self is based completely in those roles. So, according to this framework, they say as long as these people can, which is basically, I think, all of us in some way or the other, we can go on from that identity, we can go on leading a reasonably successful life, but under situations of stress, there is a collapse. Why? Because these social roles and these biological needs are not things that I can always control. So my identity is tied in this. In moments of stress, there is the experience of threat. It is difficult for me to go within myself and experience this challenge, commitment, and control. I experience a loss of control. And then they fall into a state of crisis. And we all have an element of the premorbid identity within us, so that's a different story. But how much are we allowing us? Because we all do have social roles, we all have biological needs. It's not about ignoring them. But people who are defined completely in that way, they have these issues. The other is the ideal identity. And here, it's not that they don't perform social roles or they don't identify with those social roles or biological needs. But in addition to that, they have a rich, you could say, a rich inner life.
Could you elaborate a bit on social roles?
Social roles.
Yeah.
All the roles that we play in this world, in society. So, for example, I am my nationality, my ethnicity, my job, my career. So, for example, I am an Indian, I am a psychologist, or I am a teacher, or I am a son, and I am a brother. These are roles that we play, right? I am the leader. Sorry?
Means prevents you from getting up in the morning.
No, not necessarily that. No. Sometimes it actually can prevent you from getting up in the morning. For example, let me say, if my sense of self is very deeply dependent on my, say, on my job identity, right? And I lose my job. Now I have to find a new job, right? Finding a new job means what? Sending a lot of applications and facing a lot of rejections before I am called for an interview, if ever I am called for an interview. I don't know that. Right? So when this experience happens, my sense of self is so trapped in that role, and I have lost that role, so I'm experiencing that stress and that pain now. Every day I have to wake up in the morning and engage in the process of sending applications and being rejected again and again. No, I'd rather sleep. I take an escape from that situation. So in that way, this can also be connected to not waking up in the morning, for example. The ideal identity, according to the works of Madhi, is a person, is an identity that, apart from the social roles and biological needs that we all have, there is a process of deep, rich, inner psychological symbolism that they are drawing upon for their sense of self. And this is where, from a spiritual perspective, we look at things like inner values. Values can also be connected to social roles we perform, the cultural milieu in which we exist. Values can also be connected to that. These are values connected to our social roles, but deep inner values, imagination, symbolism. Religion plays a very important role here. And there are two forms, there are many forms, but there are two forms of religious identity we can discuss here. One form of religious identity is the kind of religious identity that is dependent on religion as a social role. Religion as a means of being included or excluded from a social group. This is one way of experiencing religious identity. The other way of experiencing religious identity is religion as something that is deeply, innately, symbolically meaningful for me. So in this context, religion and religious identity is being inspired by the intrinsic motives and needs. In the other is being inspired by these extrinsic motives and needs of belonging and feeling safe in a group. And research shows people who have this extrinsic kind of religious identity, they very easily get stressed and affected by loss and trauma and all these things. Those who have this very deep inner symbolic experience of religious identity, they have an amazing amount of strength. Spirituality also, when we look at spirituality, and very interestingly, I should share another bit of research with you. People who identify themselves as spiritual and not religious get more easily influenced by stress. What does that mean? It's more fashionable to be spiritual than religious these days, right? This is going against the fashion. But what does it mean? And then you dig further, you find out, what does spirituality mean for many people? It's something of, you know, it's something, religion, there is a framework, you know, there is a commitment you have to make, there is a discipline you follow. My individual spirituality, I can adapt according to my comforts and needs, right? There is not much strength in that. Strength comes from deep commitment to a discipline. But that discipline has to be driven from within me. Not a discipline that sort of I follow because I want to be included in a group. So I'm living in a meditation center, for example, and I wake up every morning at 4 o'clock in the morning because people expect me to do that. If I do that, I'm considered a good, nice, spiritual person. There is no strength in that. Actually, I'm weakening myself over a period of time because of following those motives. Does it make sense? So this moving to a deep, inner, rich, psychological or spiritual life is what we refer to in the philosophy of Raj Yoga as soul consciousness. When we speak about soul consciousness, it is following a spiritual path. But what is a spiritual path really? It's nothing. It just means you're following the path of who you originally are, the spirit, the essence. What is that which has deep, intrinsic meaning for me? That is spirituality. What is it that has deep intrinsic meaning for me? That is spirituality. If I'm following that path, I'm following a spiritual path. You call it a religious path. You call it whatever you want. It doesn't matter. But that is the path. Because there I'm moving from the space of my deep inner values, things that have deep inner meaning for me. And everything that I do that is informed from that space. Spiritual practices I have seen in my life so many times. People are very disciplined, but they don't have much strength. Because the disciplines they follow come from the wrong space. They come from the space of the social role they are performing. The social role, for example, being a spiritual person can also become a social role. Right? And I follow it as a social role because that's the expectation of the role. I have to be nice and kind and helpful. That's the expectation of the role. But if I'm being nice and kind and helpful because it's expected of my role, I'm not gathering any strength from that. In moments of stress, I will collapse. I'm being nice and kind because that is the original nature of the soul. And I allow that to inform the act of niceness and kindness. I draw strength from that. Then I'm in control. These are the people who can display the sense of challenge, commitment and control towards stressful and difficult situations. The practice of meditation basically is, as I understand it, moving into the space of rich inner symbolism and this experiencing this rich inner life, and then letting this rich inner life that we all have inform our outward activities, engagement, social roles, all these things that we follow. Does it make sense? Let's meditate then. Anything you would like to ask before we wind up? Yes?
Does the stress differ a bit from true laws and trauma? Because laws and trauma are kind of a point in time, and stress is parasympathetic.
I'm sorry, I didn't follow your...
It's stress as a parasympathetic nervous system.
Yeah, but stress is also actually an interpretation. The body is influenced by stress. You were speaking about the response of the nervous system, right? But the body is influenced because I perceive something to be stressful. It begins with a perception. And that's why different people have different thresholds to stress. It's my perception. One person may feel I can deal with it, another person will feel I cannot deal with this. And that kicks into motion these bodily responses of the parasympathetic nervous system that you were speaking about. But it's a response to the perception. And that perception is my act of will, actually. And so we speak of transforming that act of perception. And that is what we are speaking about. But of course, when we work on these processes of looking at life as a challenge, retaining my sense of control, engaging with the world completely, commitment to the world, to the people who are even challenging, engaging with them. Over a period of time, I engage with this. I develop strength over a period of time. And that strength then helps me in dealing with situations of stress better. Shall we wind up with some meditation? Thank you. Attention away from the outside world. From the world of bodily experiences, sensations, relationships, activities. From the world of the various social roles I play. From the world of the needs of this physical body. Turning my attention inwards, I go deep within to the center of my existence, to the deepest, innermost, layer. I experience my entire existence converging into a point in the center of the brain. Into a point of light. The center of all consciousness. The soul, the spirit. My innermost existence. My original and eternal existence. I experience this physical world and this physical body disappear from my awareness. All that remains is light. The inner being, the eternal spirit, sparkling like a star. In a world of light. I experience myself to be beyond space, beyond time, in a dimension of light. In a world of silence. And in this world of silence, once again, I find myself in the presence of the Supreme. Shining down upon me
infinite source. In this moment in time, there's nothing to do, nowhere to go, no role to play. Just be. The inner self. Resting in the healing light of God, full and complete within myself. Blissful, content, and holding on to this light, this silence, and this experience of blissful fullness. This experience of deep inner richness. Super sensuous joy of being. Being the eternal spirit in the presence of God. Holding on to this blissful silence, I allow myself to return back to this realm of matter, back to this field of action. This world of the various social roles I play, back to this body, this costume of mine through which I play all these roles in the drama of life. Looking out through the windows of these eyes, listening through these ears once again, I, the eternal spirit, a speck of consciousness, at peace with myself, at peace with the world. the world from this space, from this rich inner space. All actions flowing from my will. Om Shanti. Thank you very much. Tak for ide and go after. Take care and maintain your daily discipline.